Welcome back to the MCP with Rick Alexander. In today's show, I interview Dave Bidler, the president and founder of the organization Physiology First. In this episode, we talk about the interplay of physiology and psychology. I think this is actually one of the most important conversations that I've had on air. Certainly, if you have children, this will be a relevant conversation. But also, if you're someone that deeply cares about the future of our species, I think that the issues that Physiology First is looking to provide solutions for are some of the most important facing us in the world today. Because if we're unable to manage stress, it is unlikely that we'll be able to manage anything else in our lives. We also talk about survival skills just to cope with the 21st century and all of its technology. And at the end, Dave dishes out some incredible insight and advice around gaining control of the stress in your life. You guys can learn more at physiologyfirst.org. And of course, all of this will be available in the show notes of this episode. This one was a real honor. Without further ado, onto the show. So something that I've become increasingly more, I guess, excited about, interested in, curious about is the dynamic between psychology and physiology. And the reason is because in my life, I just kept getting to finish lines, but I kept feeling like my psychology was a mess. And so then as I started to work through that, then I started realizing, oh man, I'm leaving the body behind and it's costing me psychological health. And so when I saw what you were up to, I just started getting like super curious about it. And so I was thinking maybe to kick this thing off, if you want to just talk to me a little bit about that, why that interplay and why this is so, I guess, important to you.
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons, Rick, that it's so important to us is that the conversation that you and I are having about this isn't really happening for a lot of youth, a lot of folks in the school system right now. I think people who've been looking at the dynamic interplay between psychology and physiology and really going deep into what makes us work, how that changes in a digital age as technologies change and the environment that we're in changes, that conversation is so far removed from the one that's happening about stress, anxiety, state management for a lot of young people. And we thought, man, wouldn't it be cool if we could build a more effective bridge between what we're learning at sort of the leading edges of neuroscience, sports science, you know, performance psychology, physiology, and share that with young people and say, listen, how can we talk a little bit more proactively about stress and anxiety response and where physiology and psychology meet?
We're almost becoming maladapted because of this technological revolution that we're finding ourselves sort of in union with. And so I feel like that's got to be, there's so much opportunity for your work in that space.
It feels like that. When we talk to young people about this, what we see happening as a narrative is people are generally saying, listen, you know, there's a lot of technology in the data sphere right now, and that technology is bad, or that social media is causing youth anxiety, or that we're becoming addicted to technology. And in our, you know, from our standpoint, we're sort of agnostic about the development of the future. We have a technological world that's increasing speed. The data stream is getting more cluttered. The age of automation is certainly coming. So we have this really, really powerful shift culturally and as a species to work with. So how do we work really proactively and take the reins and take the wheel of the situation? Well, we'd have to understand what technological exposure on a consistent basis does to the human nervous system, the visual system, the auditory system, sympathetic tone, the whole thing that makes us feel stressed, anxious, or present and calm. And then say, well, how do we put a toolbox together to show young people and then the community that supports them, because we're all part of the process, how to better manage our state in a rapidly changing technical world? And not to build an antithesis to the technology, but to build a skill set to use it so that it doesn't just use us.
I see. So your approach is these things are happening. This is the direction of the world. And so then how do we optimize based on what the direction it seems that we're going?
100%. What do we understand about what that would do to the human attention span, to the neurological response for gratification, the neurochemical response that is dopamine, sort of keeps us clicking the Instagram
button
1,000 times a day, you know, and to understand, I think that if the conversation again is one of antagonism, but we don't show kids an alternate solution, because I certainly haven't seen one that allows us to abandon a technological world, then they feel like there's static and an antagonism about a thing that they're linked to intrinsically. And that's a really hard place to be. It's like, well, tech is bad, but I'm on tech all day.
Right.
And there's not necessarily a proactive like conversation, as opposed to saying, well, look, you have this powerful technological tool, and our nervous system and brain can only take so much of it in a day. And the technology itself is changing the way that we pay attention. It's changing the way that we interface socially with each other. So there's this human-to-human element that has to be a major part of our day. Tech is a part of our day. Tools that allow us to de-stimulate, right, or to shift our state after a really stimulating day of technological immersion are interesting and important. So sort of, again, how do we build a skill set and a toolbox for really surviving, thriving, and innovating in the digital age, as opposed to being washed away by the data?
One of the things you just mentioned, I actually wrote a little bit in my upcoming book, which is this idea that technology is just inundating our capacity. Like, we're maxed out. Our processing systems are all essentially being maxed out. What are some of the problems that you're looking to correct, I guess, before we even start talking about the solutions?
Well, I suppose to be clear about our mission at Physiology First.
Yes.
We can talk, if we get into it, we can talk about the background of how this came about and why the organization exists. But really, we want to show young people the science of stress and anxiety management in the digital age, because we're in a completely new environment. So what do we do based on the amount of technology that we have to interface with to make sure that it doesn't put us in a state of high generalized anxiety, very low attention span? Ultimately, you know, the deeper impacts of that are we getting what we need as a physical creature and being, so that things like depressive episodes don't come into play because we're not moving, eating, sleeping, doing the other things that keep us, our brains healthy? And can we build a curriculum that shows kids that information has to be constantly updated because technological development is exponential? It happens really fast. When we ask kids to sort of visualize A, their big goals with utmost clarity, because that's a thing that we can have them do that is, I think, so important, because then they have an idea of where they'd like to go. Then they can visualize the barriers that may prevent them from reaching that goal. We can talk about the role that not having stress and anxiety management skills in the digital age plays in stopping us from reaching very important goals. And that's just sort of at the heart of our work with Physiology First, is helping kids realize that we're not saying, hey, you guys should be less stressed, you should be less anxious. We're saying, hey, I bet you guys have awesome dreams and incredible visions and things you're really excited to achieve. And there's a journey to get there, and there's going to be a lot of challenges on that journey. What's the skill set in 2020 and going forward to meet those challenges, jump over barriers, and get to those goals? It would look like managing our physiology at a time when it is definitely becoming harder to do that, as you pointed out.
I actually love that approach, because one of the things I've seen, you know, my sister is 16 years younger than me. So I've been able to be an adult watching her go through, you know, her childhood in middle school and high school. One of the things that's interested me is that she came into this world. I didn't, right? So like, we can feel the maladaption, but she came into it. And so what I'm seeing is that she's being prescribed drugs. And who knows whether the prescription is correct or not. But what I would say is, like, there are certain things, like I've seen her neuroticism be moved trait to the right, her neuroticism trait be moved to the right. And so certain things, it's like she thinks it's her because she was born into this world. Whereas I think if you were to pull her out, put her in the wilderness for a certain amount of time, she would find that her homeostasis is probably different than she's being medicated for. And so I'm wondering, is that something you've seen? And whether it is or not, I do think that's probably the genius in your approach, is it helps get through that.
It really, really does. And we're seeing it crystal clear in this powerful interface with students almost every day. We've had 4 student presentations so far this week. This is middle school, high school, and college. And we get to really kick it about stress and anxiety and how people are feeling. And one of the most powerful tools that lets us do exactly what you were just pointing out is we start every presentation with some goal clarity from the kids to let them know that it's about them. And then we show them that as an organization, we want to know who's doing the most leading edge, quantified, interesting, powerful, and useful work around the problem that we seek to solve. And in our eyes, the person who moved that needle in a powerful, visible way that interested us and drew us in was Dr. Andrew Huberman of Stanford University. And we saw that what he was doing was looking at the stress and anxiety response through the lens of neuroscience in a virtual reality environment that him and his team at Stanford created. Mm-hmm. And they said, if we just put people in this sort of box with fears, stressors, things that would mimic the stress and anxiety of a day, not terrifying things, but things that would upregulate the stress response, and we would put some sensors on them, we could then study what the response is. And then we could also learn not only what is happening physiologically when we are stressed, anxious, or in states of fear, but what mechanical acts, like breathing, changing patterns of vision, what things can people do to move their state when they're feeling stressed and anxious. So we show the students at every presentation this video from Stanford. And they're usually pretty intrigued by it because it's pretty cool VR. It's like, oh, that's what happens when a human is anxious and stressed, mildly. Like when you have to give a presentation at class, or you're going to give a talk, or you're in traffic. This is what happens to heart rate, pupil dilation, skin temperature, sweat glands, respiration rate, the whole puzzle. But it also allows us then to use a chart that came out of that experience, where we can look at states that we can be in, sort of agnostically across a board, in a way that most people can relate to. So on one end of the spectrum, we have panic. And in every group we've ever presented to, the students can relate to being in a panicked state of understanding panic. Then we have awake but alert. I'm awake but I am up. Awake but I'm calm. Sleepy, asleep. Coma, dead. If they can see this arc of states that we can relate to, we can then ask them, what tools do you have at your disposal when you're awake and alert and you're ready to rock the world, but it's 2:15 in the morning and you have to get up at 5 a.m.? What thing can you do? What things do you do? And they give us good answers. And then we can ask, okay, other side of the coin or curve, it's 2 p.m. and you still have a test, you still have a practice, you still have a date, you have all these things. What do you do to shift to being more awake and alert? And the answers that we get, to your point about pharmacology playing a big role in this, a very common answer is, when I am awake and cannot sleep, I take my pills. And a very common answer, when I'm asleep and can't get awake, which we can certainly all relate to, is I drink a lot of coffee. So they understand the mechanisms of getting from asleep to awake and back, and they have a certain toolbox. Caffeine, prescription pills, sleeping aids, sleeping pills. Then we can ask without any judgment, you know, well, what's a tool that A, is optimal, because it has the least detriment to long-term health? B, what is a tool that's accessible, meaning you always have it and you can always use it? And C, what's a tool that's universal? It's going to meet all of us in the room. And that's what allows us to begin to talk about breathing and the role of breath control and understanding the science of stress and anxiety management, and giving these kids some tangible ways to actually reduce the physiological response that is anxiety, and for them to watch that work. Things like lowering your heart rate, for example. We'll ask students in the presentation, is heart rate something we can control? Many of them will say, well, no. And I'll say, okay, who here has an Apple Watch that says what your heart rate is? And they'll say, I all do, everyone does. We'll say, okay, a simple breathing exercise. What happened to the heart rate? Oh, it universally dropped. We definitely have a lot more control over these processes. We just have to learn to turn the dials.
Are you creating that parasympathetic state by doubling the length of the exhale to the inhale?
Yeah, you know, that's such a good question, because depending on the time that we have with the students, we love to ask the question. After we show them that breathing is important to the state that we're in, both from the standpoint that a breathing exercise can reduce anxiety, and that dysfunctional breathing can upregulate anxiety. When they understand that bidirectional loop, you can be anxious and stressed and use your breath to control that response, or you can be breathing erratically, hyperventilating, and upregulating that response. And if someone doesn't take a look at the physiology first, you end up with psychological analysis for a physiological problem. So depending on how much time we have with them, we love to ask the next question. If breathing is important, what makes us breathe? What drives the urge for a human to take a breath? And more lately, I've had some exposure to the answer. They'll say, well, it's carbon dioxide. Okay, cool. Well, the room's full of oxygen, your bloodstream's full of oxygen, but carbon dioxide drives your urge to breathe. Well, let's see how it plays out. We'll put a 1 minute timer on the clock. We'll ask everybody to just count how many breaths they normally take in 1 minute. And to do their best to not modify that for the sake of the test, because they don't know what outcome would be good or bad. We'll all do that for a minute. We'll go around the room, maybe there's 30, 40 kids, And we'll find out that some students are taking 9 breaths a minute, and some are taking 30 plus, around the clock, all day, every day. And then we can circle back and say, well, what do you think if somebody was taking, I don't know, 30 plus breaths a minute, where might they live on that chart most likely physiologically? Oh, probably between awake and alert, veering towards the other side of that, that looks like a higher level of anxiety, or at least the set point for anxiety is higher. What if somebody was taking 8 or 9 breaths a minute? What is optimal breathing? And often there's a lot of buy-in from the kids to think, wait a minute, I've been breathing all my life. If how I breathe can drive me towards an anxious state, and managing anxiety is so super important for me to get to my most important goals, I should pay attention to this stuff and see if I can't figure out this whole breathing thing a little more and how it might be advantageous to breathe optimally. That's why they start to care about breathing, not because of the biochemistry, but because it can be an impetus to reaching your goals, and they want the key to that door.
I love the idea of physiology first, so that you don't end up treating something psychologically that could be handled. But my question would be, is breath the only tool, the only indicator? Are there other times where you feel like the physiology could solve? Because, you know, I found myself in many situations where I'm on the anxious end of the spectrum that you're talking about, and I find it very hard to reel my breath back in, no matter how much I try. Sometimes it's existential stress, right? But sometimes it's like, if it's acute, I see like I can pull it back in easier. But if I'm just stressed about life for some reason, it does seem to be a little harder to tether that breath in and get control over it. I don't know if you found that.
Well, you know, it's such a great question. And I realized as you asked it that I didn't fully answer the question before it. So I'd love to tie the two together. You asked if we use slow exhale breathing.
Yep.
And we do. If we have a gauge on their carbon dioxide tolerance and breathing function. And the reason for that is that if someone's breathing optimally, a slow exhale can often induce a parasympathetic response. But if someone's over breathing all day, they're actually blowing off excess amounts of carbon dioxide to begin with. And that can upregulate or ramp up the anxiety response. And any further slower exhalation can be the exact opposite of what we want. We actually need to reintroduce carbon dioxide to the system. And that can be complex to explain to kids in a half hour or 45 minute lecture. So when we show them that relationship between carbon dioxide and oxygen, we then try to give them resources to further explore so that we don't go down a rabbit hole that becomes A, boring, B, hard to understand and use. But when they realize that mastering your breathing is really based on knowing the biology and understanding your own physiology and who you are, then they can start to say, well, how do I put this into a program? And the program that we built, which is called Breathe to Perform for them to use, to answer your next question, has 4 elements. It has breath awareness, breath control, breath training, and breath practice. And we talk them through what that means so that in those moments of peak stress, or you're just like, wow, I am losing control of my state, that reeling it back through breath becomes a more familiar trained response. We tell if I'm training an athlete, I don't want them to only experience extreme stress on the court or on game day for the first time. I want them to train it. So we find with the breath work that if they're building a daily breathing practice, and the idea of using breath to control nervous system state is something that they're doing every day, then doing it when the everything hits the fan, it's a lot more accessible. But if they only wait for everything to hit the fan to remember this breath stuff, we find that they don't have the skill set. They haven't trained it yet.
When I'm in a state of emergency, if you haven't worked on it, it's like, how could you take it back? And so then that leads to the follow-on question for people that are listening to this. What do you see as, I guess, like, I don't want to say minimum, but like, what is the practice look like? Because at least I've seen people really have trouble with mindfulness practices in our world of fast forward and go, and they just don't commit the time. So what does a practice like this look like for you?
Well, one thing that I learned, Rick, from years and years of coaching that I used to get so terribly wrong, and I'm working to refine it, is when I first started coaching people in sport, I'd give them this laundry list of things that if they just did these 17 things on this list every day, everything would be optimal. It took me a long time to realize what it took to create a sustainable habit and to create a practice. So what we share is, in terms of the breath practice, we have a free app that takes them through guided breathing exercises. We tell them 1 minute a day, 1 minute a day, devote 1 minute a day to conscious, mindful breathing. and sync your breath to this rhythm at a minimum. And then you may find that as you do that 1 minute a day, it could be quite relaxing. Maybe the minute turns into two, maybe the minute turns into three. But it becomes also very hard to tell ourselves that we don't have a minute a day. I may not have 5 minutes, I may not have 10 minutes. Time is the ultimate currency right now.
Right.
When we can identify that this is important to us because it will give us a tool for stress and anxiety management, and that 1 minute a day is the minimal dose, people who want in on that can start by doing 1 minute a day daily breathing practice. And then when everything gets crazy later on in the day, they get the DM or the text message or the, you know, the, all the stuff happens. Somebody cuts you off in traffic, you're running 5 minutes late. They can remember that feeling of taking control over their physiology, and they can apply it in those moments when it matters most.
What is it that pushes you into this work? Like, why do this? What motivates you for this?
You know, it was, so I own a gym called The Distance Project in Freeport, Maine. And we work initially The Distance Project. I am an ultra marathon athlete, and The Distance Project was a place to train endurance athletes when we first opened up like 5 or 6 years ago. And really early in that journey, we started to realize that you can be an endurance athlete and run 100-mile races, and that does not solve all problems. It does not fix all things. It does not lead to happiness, fulfillment, peace, and all that stuff. So The Distance Project and Go the Distance morphed into trying to find the edges of our potential and to try to push one another towards growth, push ourselves towards growth, and to really go the distance as far as we can into understanding who we are, what we are, and how we can help each other get better. And it led us to meet some amazing athletes and coaches. And we built this little tribe here that has really become, you know, incredibly tight. We see each other every night to train. And we talk about some pretty leading edge concepts around neuroscience, neurology, the things happening at the edge of the performance world. But then we'll go work with a high school team, and we'll realize the gap is becoming greater. There aren't necessarily many bridges being built between the leading edge of sports performance and sort of this, whatever it is that we do, the self-development piece, trying to get to know how we operate better and learn more about ourselves. So we started inviting teams into the gym to talk about breathing and things like that. And we realized that these kids were really lighting up when we talked about the things that mattered to them a lot, and gave them a science-based approach to managing the barriers like stress and anxiety to reaching goals. It wasn't just motivation, and it wasn't just a biology class. It was a blend of the two. And I thought, well, this seems really impactful. How do we scale it? One of my first questions always is, if it's impactful, how do we not have just 20 people in a gym in Freeport, Maine doing it? How do we scale it? So we started to put the seminar series together, which was Breathe to Perform, and to share it with more schools in the area, and the demand got even higher. And we thought, wouldn't it be cool to be able to do this like full time? Because the student anxiety crisis that we're seeing.
Massive.
Maine has one in four kids in Maine is diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. And we're thinking, well, if we understand that the future of like our country and ultimately to kind of grand vision, that's the world, is gonna be based on the mental health and well-being of everyone who's gonna lead it in a couple of years, that we have to find a set, an inroad into showing young people how their brains and bodies work in the digital age. And when we saw that what I hadn't seen it happening, we said, well, we can build an organization that focuses on that. We can scale a seminar series that creates a positive, proactive, science-based narrative on goal attainment and stress management. And if we can do that, we can ultimately help to shape a new conversation around, again, what it means to reach your goals and to feel awesome and to do all the things that these kids want to do, respecting the technological environment that they're heading into and how many barriers to attention. Yeah, I mean, look at just attention in and of itself. The ability to pay attention to a goal and pursue it and remember things of great importance and articulate them and remain flexible in an age of automation where jobs that are here today may not be here tomorrow. That if we could do that full time, that we can make a big impact and we can work to build a bridge between the high performance community and all communities. So about 9 months ago, we went full into building Physiology First as a nonprofit organization. And we held a fundraising run, which was, I did a 100-mile run around the local high school track. We invited high school kids to come out, and news came out. And we got to start this community conversation, how we best support youth in the digital age for stress and anxiety management and goal attainment. that was successful for us. We got some early seed funding to be able to scale the organization. And then someone contacted us from Pittsburgh, Dave Simonick. And he said, well, you know, what if we could take this model, because they can't get you guys down to Pittsburgh, what if we can take it and build sort of an ambassador program where community members take the seminar and they walk into their schools and they present it? And I thought, that is gold. That's gold, because we can theoretically be in public schools all throughout the country within a year. So at this point, I think we're up to 11 or 12 states who have done our digital conference call and taken our information into their communities. And the goal is that ultimately we can scale this to be more or less common knowledge in the stress and anxiety mitigation sphere in public schools, and then ultimately work to build additional research, deeper curriculum, and at the end of the day, also connect these students and teachers to one another. So you're having this wonderful intergenerational conversation on meeting stress and anxiety demands in the future.
Something you mentioned is this idea that, like, if you are worried about the future, right, you would want to develop the people that are going to be making decisions and teach them how to manage their own stress. And I heard a lecture the other day where they were talking about just sort of what the environment's like in the White House and how everybody is reactive in the White House. And so it's always go, go. It's always sympathetic. And I just thought, man, how could you lead if you can't stop? If you can't, like, assess, like, it with clarity, right? Because when you're reactive, it's a very different animal. You're not making the same kind of decisions. Offense and defense are very different animals. So, like, very different positions and ways to go about life. And so I love giving people the keys to allow them to play offense, but you can't do that unless you can stop for a second. You can stop playing defense for a second. So beautiful there. That's, I love that.
I love that articulation. And, you know, we work outside of the nonprofit world. We work with companies, and we work with companies that work to be at the edges of their industry on stress management and anxiety management. I'll never forget one of the first seminars we ever did for this big financial team. And the very beginning of the seminar, one of the people said to me, listen, I am stressed. I am stressed out of my mind that I have to be here and can't be doing real work. And all I could think was, well, do you think that good work can be done in a state of, like, really high stress? We have to get a handle on this. And I'll share that with the kids sometimes when we're talking, because they might think that all the adults have it, like, figured out. People like in, like, you know, the financial community, the tech community are all just, like, you know, sitting in, like, cryotherapy centers and, you know, saunas and just, like, completely chill. I'm like, you could out, like breath and stress management is, like, the great equalizer. You guys think that you're in a disadvantageous position, because we work with some kids in very affluent areas. We work with some kids in very, very poverty-stricken, resource-deprived areas. And we'll always share with them, look, breath becomes the equalizer because we have access to the same technologies. We're on Instagram, we're on YouTube, we're on Facebook. We have this phone thing, which is like a supercomputer. We have ideas and dreams and things we can put out on display on a market or just creative outlets. And our ability to manage stress kind of levels the playing field a little bit, because some of the people who you might look up to and think have it all together, believe me, you know, none of us have it all together. We're all trying to figure out the stress puzzle in 2020 and moving forward. So we love to meet them as peers in that and say, let's work on it together. Let's look at it objectively. And one of the most powerful pieces of the seminar for me as to witness is, we'll ask kids, you know, who here thinks that anxiety and stress are major problems? And every hand goes up in every room we've ever been in. I'll say, cool. Who here can define anxiety or stress? And I've never seen a single hand go up ever. And I think, well, that's the problem. At that point, we're talking about abstract concepts. And if that's the case, we can only produce abstract, vague solutions. What is stress? What is anxiety? And then we pull the kids in to examine it together so that we can collaboratively build a skill set with them.
They're just adapting to their environment, but it doesn't mean that, like, the financial people and the people in the White House that we're talking about, it's like, they're not actually, health is not, performance and health can be different markers. So
well said, Rick.
Is there anything else that you consider to be important to your message that you'd like to talk about today? I think
that it's important for people to know that, you know, when we talk about this work, it's complex. In that, I think a lot of people initially thought that we were just raising awareness about youth mental health And we have a really interesting linguistic thing happening culturally right now, where when you say mental health, people assume mental illness. We have a mental health awareness month. I don't hear a conversation around like cognitive optimization and neurological health. I hear a conversation that kind of talks about mental illness under this banner of health. And I think that's really weird. I think it's a strange linguistic thing. So when we talk about youth mental health, and people think we're raising awareness about mental illness, that's a very hard thing to get behind, because we only raise awareness about things we think we can't change. Otherwise, we build practices and tools and strategies and movements. When we understand the changeable nature of the brain, and they understand that we're teaching these kids real tools that are scientifically based in the latest neuroscience to meet the challenges of the future, then they realize that we're doing something other than raising awareness. We're a very action-oriented group. We want these kids to have tools, because in a couple of years, they are going to be the political leaders. They're going to be the business owners. They're going to be the founders of companies. They're going to be dealing with all the shit we left them, right, in terms of challenges and complexity. And if we want to envision the world of the future, these are the leaders of it. They're going to run, they're going to drive the bus. So our investment in their mental state, you don't have to be someone who cares deeply about youth mental health to care deeply about the future. And that's one thing we want to make so clear, is that I kind of feel like if we can present this as a campaign talking about the future, everybody can and hopefully will get behind that and realize that it's an investment we can't afford not to make.
I think in the future, any way that I can get this message out, I think I definitely would love to. I definitely would love to.
Oh, I was just going to say, the last thing I'd love people to know is we're going to be doing a big run at the end of the school year. And it's going to be a chance to really put our message out there and engage kids, engage community members. I'm doing a run from Portland, Maine to Washington, D.C. And I'm going to run to the Department of Education and share some of the work we've been doing around curriculum building for schools and educational leaders on the science of stress and anxiety management. And we're going to be making a short film about that. So hopefully, if people are following your show and they can sort of follow that run along, we'll really get to go deeper into the narrative and see sort of the impact it's having on, that we've seen have it on in communities, and get involved and maybe support that if they're interested.
Awesome. Great. If you could have morning coffee with anybody in the world, who would it be, dead or alive? And what would you talk about?
Such a good question, Rick. I'm going to have to go with an actual mentor of mine who I get to have coffee with like once a year. And every time I do, he blows me away and helps me sharpen my insight around the work that we're doing. His name is Adam Robinson. Adam is the founder of the Princeton Review and a brilliant thinker. And I got to see him speak in New York years ago. He was on the Tim Ferriss Show, and it was a live taping, and I got to see him speak. And I thought, this guy's mind was so crystal clear, and it seemed like he had some real insight into not only high performance, but happiness. And it blew me away. I thought, I'd love to have coffee with him. I actually made that a goal, to have coffee with him. And I sent him some emails. I worked to try to get in touch with him. And he was kind and generous enough to actually respond and answer some questions and engage in dialogue. And so on my 35th birthday, I just went for it. I said, dude, is there any way that we can meet up and have a cup of coffee in Manhattan? And he said, let's go. And I was like, wow. And I had coffee with this guy who'd been a mentor. And I idolized his approach and his work. We had a cup of coffee and he blew my mind and gave me such great advice and such great clarity as to where I was going. And so we sort of made it an annual birthday thing. And on the last time that I had coffee with him, with Adam, he said something just in passing that ended up being so, he has a way of doing this, saying something that ended up being so profound that I hung on it for a year. And it definitely fits in to our work at Physiology First. We were talking about products and things. And he said, like, you know, for example, something that would never sell would be a book about foresight. Because if you need foresight to know that you needed it. And if you had foresight, you wouldn't need the book. And I thought, wow, that's kind of the secret to everything, right? If I had foresight, right? I bought a book about foresight, who would buy it? You'd have to have foresight to know that was something you needed. And if you had foresight, you wouldn't need the book. So right now, as we walk around a city street, there are dentists walking around probably thinking, I can't believe these people don't floss. I cannot believe they don't see the detrimental nature of not flossing 2 times a day. And there's accountants walking around cities saying, I can't believe these people don't file this status on their taxes. Don't they realize how much money that would save them? And we live in boxes and we can't see outside of them. So we end up with this curse of knowledge that what is painfully obvious to us has now somehow simultaneously become obvious to all people. And then we can build from that, instead of the empathy that's necessary for communication, we can build almost in an elitist nature or a callousness or a cynicism that what's painfully obvious to us is not painfully obvious to anyone else. So when we apply that to the youth mental health work, we're looking at this problem as one of the biggest in the world. Why isn't that on the front page of everything that is, you know, is looked at as a major thing to act on? Because it's not on everybody's minds right now. It's our job to become the communicators and storytellers and the organization that helps kids tell their story, communities tell their story, and make this something that is eventually more obvious. Because when you realize that these kids are literally like are the future, our investment in setting them on the right track so that they can succeed becomes so apparent. But until you see it, you don't see it. And when you do, you can't see. It's all that you can see. It's crystal clear. So Adam has helped me crystallize my thinking. In that regard, I can't thank him enough for it. He's a gem, a beautiful dude.
That was an incredible insight. David, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. I think your insight and what you're doing for the world is incredible.
Really can't thank you enough. It's been such an honor, man. Thank you so much for the chance to kind of share our work and to connect with you.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Hey everybody, thanks for tuning into the show. If you did like it, this show and every show is powered by the Clarity Academy. That is our in-house training program. It's a 12-week online course developed to help you figure out the right mindset to get exactly what you want out of life and to figure out who you really are, to figure out who you were before the world made you believe that you had to be somebody else. I think your best life and the way that you're best positioned to impact this world is found somewhere in your own authenticity, in your own uniqueness, and we just aren't taught how to double down on it. So if you're interested in that, you go to rickalexander.com, click on the Clarity Academy for details. Registration is open. I would love to see you on the inside.